We just don't have time. There's four chapters in Philippians, and we have four Wednesday nights in October, and I want to cover a chapter a week. Incidentally, I already have a series on Philippians that's got 27 lessons in it. And so now after we get through with this, it'll have 31 lessons. So that shows you the messaging that's available to us in the book of Philippians. But as you look at the book itself, it's a very practical book because it's a believer's book, as one has identified. And what this means is that as you go through the book of Philippians, you're going to find words and phrases and concepts that will help you to survive Christianity in an unchristian world. There are some, as one individual calls it, choice morsels that you will find. It's a very practical book. Most of us are deluged by problems and adversity, and there's always the wonderful comfort that comes from talking with somebody that's been over those struggles. We couldn't find a better fella to talk to than the Apostle Paul. He was defeated according to the worldly standpoints, but he writes in the book of Philippians as a victor. He is victorious now in his state as he's writing the book of Philippians. He's in jail. He's in prison. And he is chained to the elite guard 24/7. But he writes as a victor, and he talks about joy and grace and peace, and he points us to the higher ground. There is a higher ground than what we have here. Pity the person who thinks that this world is all there is. Isn't that a sad existence? If there's nothing more than what we have in this world, then we're in bad shape. And the Apostle Paul helps us to lift our eyes up and to see that. As we look at the Apostle Paul, we find, I think, a very good comment from this fellow. He says, "He who loses himself to the dynamics of this epistle will emerge more than a conqueror through Jesus Christ." And I hope that's where you are 4 weeks from tonight, that you will be able to look at these enemies of joy in your life, and you will be more than a conqueror because of that. There are three words in the book of Philippians that are repeatedly stressed, and as these repetitions are made, we come to a very basic message. And that message is that only as one has his mind set on Christ will true joy be experienced. Now, how is that put together? Well, first of all, you have the first word, that is the word joy, or rejoicing, or gladness. And this is found over 19 times. Second, you have the word mind, remember, or think. They're used 16 times. Joy is how a believer thinks. It's not how he feels. You can be joyful and have a very sad face. You can be joyful and be in the midst of the greatest crises that you've ever lived in your life. Joy is not how you feel. Joy is that inward attitude that comes from life. The Greek word is chara, and it refers really to a calm delight that you have. That is a sense of worth that you have. And it talks about your internal emotions, not your external demonstrations. So remember that. You can be joyful, but your face be sad. But another the third word is that of Christ. Now, this is amazing. You go through the book of Philippians and you mark the references to Christ. And mention of Christ is found over 70 times in this short book. 70 times. That means that there is one reference to Christ every 1.5 verse. Now, that's amazing. And so as you combine all of this, you find that the book of Philippians stresses our attitude, and we'll see that next week, Philippians 2:5. Have this attitude, Paul says, in yourself that Jesus had. But it's your attitude that comes because of your relationship with Christ and because of your inward vision that you have. The basic point is that of self-control. Joy is really based upon a person's self-control. It's not how you think that that determines your happiness in life. It's how you think that determines the victory and your overcoming in life. And many individuals fail to enjoy life because they have committed themselves and their thought processes to what they think is idealistic. And they say, well, joy, I ought to be joyful, and I'm going to find joy by doing this and doing that. And so some of them will look to things, and we'll talk about that in chapter 3. Some say, well, if I can just have a new, and you fill in the blank, then that's going to make me happy. Well, the problem is they want happiness and not joy. And so we're talking about joy in life. Basically, the message is what the proverb writer said, Proverbs 23 and verse 7, as he thinks within himself, so is he. So as we look at Christianity, Christianity is really a mind game that we have. It's a mind battle. Paul says that our duty, we are warring, not according to carnal warfare, but our warring is to take every thought captive into Christ. And that's exactly what Philippians is telling us right here. As you think within yourself, so are you. You are what you think. And that's the message that we're going to see repeated in the book of Philippians. Now, there are four enemies to joy. I was reading an author that was writing in the 1800s, and he mentioned this. And after he mentioned that, it's curious because it's really a catchy point, and it's been mentioned constantly since then. But he said there's four enemies that that steal joy from your life. And the book of Philippians is a survival manual so that you can escape from giving up your joy. What steals your joy? Well, each chapter we'll talk about it. Tonight we'll talk about chapter 1. There are circumstances in your life that are not joyful, and they will steal your joy. Next week we'll talk about people. There are certain people in life that steal your joy. They're parasites. They just suck it out of you. Number 3, third chapter, there are things, there are worldly possessions, there's that pursuit of possessions, where possessions possess you. You don't possess your possessions. And we'll talk about that in the third week. And then the fourth week is one that I think, you don't worry about that. You know, nobody worries, right? So you don't have to be concerned about joy being... Worry is really a suffocating experience, and it just kind of chokes you. And worry can be choked out of you. And chapter 4 talks about that. So Paul tells us in Philippians how we can overcome these adversaries. And that's what we will do. Each week we'll cover a chapter, and we will see how cultivating the proper mind of joy will help us to be more than conquerors whenever it comes to warding off and guarding against these thieves. Here then, the book of Philippians, a survival manual where you can survive earthly life. It works, and best of all, it's free. You don't have to pay anything for it. It's given to you. Here's the directives, but it requires you to develop a thinking process that results in self-control in every situation. Let's look at chapter 1 now as we begin talking about how dire circumstances can steal joy from your life. Well, Job's assessment is so correct. Job 14:1, how many times have you quoted this to yourself? More man born of a woman, short-lived, and he's full of turmoil. Isn't that so true? It doesn't matter how many years you have on this earth, it's short. And you'll have some good times, but you're going to have some bad times. And when Job wrote this in chapter 14, or stated this in chapter 14, he was in the midst of some big problems. And he says, man that's born of a woman, how short his life is, and it's all filled with sorrow. We are constantly plagued by trouble and strife, and as a result of this bombardment, relatively few will find joy and peace in their life. Now, the Christian's attitude is the critical point here. The Christian's attitude toward the undesirable and uncomfortable circumstances gives insight to your self-control. If you're in the midst of a dire circumstance and you are overcome by that, look at the self-control. You have control in that situation. An interesting point. How many of us love to sit by a babbling brook or a waterfall, and it's so comforting, so consoling? But it's that way because that water is hitting those rocks and dropping in the depths. And if it wasn't for all of the adversaries within that water path, there would not be a sound, would it? And so that babbling brook, the roaring waterfall that gives you such comfort, comes because there were problems that that water faced. Now, the same thing is true in your life as well. An old lady once lived, and she was always so cheerful. Everybody just kind of shook their head and wondered, how could anybody be that cheerful? Finally, somebody says, well, you must have some clouds in your life, don't you? Some kind of problems. And she said, clouds? She says, well, yes, of course, but if there were no clouds, from where would the blessed showers come? It would be kind of difficult to live in sunshine all your life, wouldn't you? Well, apply that point and that principle to Christianity, to your circumstances. In the midst of dire circumstances, you have a choice. You have control. And if anybody ever had the right to claim victimization over their life situation, it'd be Paul. Paul was victimized over and over and over again. He had more problems than you and I would ever come in a number of lifetimes. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul speaks about this. He categorizes, he's actually defending his apostleship in the midst of this. He's facing a dire circumstance. Somebody says, well, you're not qualified, and Paul says, I am. But listen to what he says there in 2 Corinthians 11. He says, I've had labors, imprisonments, I've been beaten without number. There's so many times I've been beaten, I've lost track. He says, in dangers often, 5 times I've been lashed by the Jews with 39 lashes. 3 times I was beat with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. He says, I've been in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers. He said, I've even been in dangers from my fellow countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the cities, dangers in the wilderness, dangers in the sea, dangers among false brethren. Wow. Was Paul a victim? Were there circumstances in his life, situations he didn't? Absolutely. Paul says, I have been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights and hunger and thirst without food. I've been cold. I've been in exposure. And there's that daily pressure on me of a concern for the church. Now, as he writes in Philippians chapter 1, Paul is in the midst of another circumstance that he really did not want, and that is imprisonment. And he points out in Philippians 1 and verse 13, that he is imprisoned. Some of your translations will have their chains or bondage. He is bound. And what the Greek term there literally means is an impediment that he is facing, some kind of disability. I read a sermon that was based on this, and it was talking about the chains that bind us. And it's talking about all those excuses that people say, well, I would love to do that, but I have this that's holding me down, or I have this that's... Paul would not hear of that. In Ephesians 6 and verse 20, Paul points out there, he says, I am an ambassador in chains. Now, think about this. You come to a personal inventory time, and it asks a very sobering question, difficult. Question asked, are you joyful in your circumstances? I don't know what your circumstances are right now. I don't know what's happened. Maybe you've had a terrible, lousy, no good, worm-eating day. But how are you dealing with that? How is your day going? Are you joyful? I'm not saying, are you feeling good? Remember, joy is an inward attitude. It's not the outward expression. Are you joyful? And there's a reason that you ought to be joyful, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But David makes this point in Psalm 119 and verse 71. David said, it is good for me that I have been afflicted. Now think about that. I don't know if Paul would say that. You know, you look at somebody that's been afflicted, somebody that's had some real big problems, and they say, it's been good that I've gone this way. Well, David said that. Well, let's look at some directives of inspiration. How can we have this joy in our life? Well, there's two words, and both of these are so impressive as you begin to think on them. First of all, chapter 1 and verse 16, Paul says, I am set, or positioned, or placed. What that word refers to is a setting, a deliberate placement. It's a primary verb, and it refers to a deliberate decision in the placement of an object or a person. I often liken it to setting a table. You set the table. There's a certain way, I never get it right, but there's a certain way you put the forks and the spoons and the knives and the 15 other pieces of silverware that are totally useless. But there's a certain way to do that. See, that's setting. That's the deliberate. That's the word that we're talking about here in this particular place. Paul has been put in the place he's in for the defense of the gospel. Whatever the circumstances you face in your life, understand this, that the Lord is in control. He has placed you there. It's not His fault you're there, but the Lord is in control. And you need to remember that. Sin's corruption is responsible for the dire circumstances in life, but even in those dire circumstances, God is in control. Don't forget that. That's the root of joy. But look at another word. The Lord will succeed. And that's seen in the word perfect in chapter 1 and verse 6. What He begins, He is going to perfect. Now, I like this term. I like the other too. But this one is really significant. It refers to fulfilling completely or to finishing, to performing. And the idea here is that it's on a linear aspect, and that means it's going forward, and it talks about the completion of a process, finishing. You're finishing. The Lord is finishing in your life. The stress is on the active execution of energy to complete. What He has begun in you, Paul says He's going to perfect. He's going to finish that. Those developing this mind of Christ find assurance, find peace that God's work is being completed in their life. Paul will speak about this. Two weeks we'll talk about this in Philippians 3. Paul says, not that I have already obtained it or already become perfect, but I press on. He says, I do not regard myself as laying hold on it yet. It's not finished. He says, but one thing I do, Forgetting what lies behind. We'll talk about this word forgetting. A lot of folks say, oh, I just can't forget. That's not what he's talking about here. But Paul says, forgetting what lies behind, reaching forward, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward calling of God in Christ. Whatever circumstances you face in life cannot prevent God's will from being completed. Know that. Be encouraged by that. There is an absolute guarantee that God is making you. God will complete His plan. He's going to finish it. And so we need to trust in Him. Romans 8, 31 through 39, powerful verse illustrating this. If God is for us, who's against us? See, God has control. He has set us. God will perfect. He will finish what He's doing. Who will bring a charge against God's elect? Who will separate us from the love of Christ? We overwhelmingly conquer through Him, Paul affirms in Romans chapter 8. What power that is. Well, let's look at the diligence that comes. In order for me to accomplish this and to find this great joy in my life, there is obligatory actions that are weighing on me. I just can't sit and wallow in my misery and bemoan and whine about the dire circumstances I'm in. Well, they may be bad, and I may feel exactly like, in fact, Elijah did a lot of times. If you are one time that I think of, him and his juniper tree, he felt really sorry for himself. Well, okay, you can feel sorry for yourself, but don't stay there, okay? Stop the pity party and get up and get moving. How do we do that? How do I get out of that situation where the dire circumstance has almost buried me? And how do I go onward to that prize where God will complete and finish? Well, there are several points that are brought out. The first one is thanksgiving. A thankful heart is not a self-centered heart. Again, we come to this concept of self-control. Many times, whenever you're faced with a dire circumstance, it's so tempting to feel sorry and let that self-pity just kind of eat you up and just overcome everything that you see. But you see, a thanksgiving attitude prevents that, because thanksgiving is not a selfish emotion. Thanksgiving is looking out from yourself. Bad circumstances lead us to turn our vision inward. We become unthankful. We think only about how ourself is being mistreated. Folks will say, well, I didn't sign on for this. This isn't for me. I didn't do this. Nope, that's not the attitude we're talking about at this point. The self-centered look erases the larger vision of everything. You see, we need to lift our eyes up and look beyond ourselves. The heart of thanksgiving is not going to allow circumstances to control them. And as you look at what Paul says in Philippians 1 and verse 18, he says, yes, I will rejoice. Well, he's going to rejoice because in chapter 1, he's thankful for the fellowship of his brethren and the benevolence of the Almighty God. The second word is the word discernment. And oh, I wish we had time to talk about this. Proverbs chapters 1 through 10 stresses this. A number of years ago, I presented a series of lectures to Fried Hardeman on the book of Proverbs. Actually, I didn't get past chapter 10, and I really didn't get past this word discernment, because God says the Christian finds joy in discernment. And you read Proverbs 1 through 10, you'll see an illustration of this point as well. But discernment refers to a personal judgment. Actually, it refers to the sniff test, you know, whether you sniff something to see how good it is. That's a personal judgment that you make on this. You look at your circumstances and you judge those circumstances, and you understand that God is in control. That causes you to refocus. You're not blinded by the adverse circumstances, but your vision sees the Almighty God in control. Look down in Philippians 1 and verse 19. Paul says, I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through, powerful word. Through, it's actually a little bitty Greek word, dia, only three letters here. But the word through is significant. This is how his deliverance is going to come. It's coming through, and the word through there refers to a channel, a means by which that energy is going to be focused. Paul says, so I will come through and I will be delivered as a result of your prayers and the providence, the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. So here, the solution to Paul's dire circumstance was through the channel of prayer and providence. Same thing applies to you and me. Look at a third term, the word focus. Focus on the mission. As you focus on the mission, you're not going to lose sight of what's before you. My granddaughter, who is, what's Kenley, three? Four. Five. She grew. She's five. Wayne, need help, brother. She's 5 years old. So she was going to cook some cookies. And I really didn't want any cookies, but I said, Kenley, I'm hungry. When are they going to be ready? She hadn't even started yet. I said, I need cookies. I want them right now. Where are the cookies? She said, Pop, you've got to focus. This is a five-year-old. You've got to focus. If you don't focus, you're not going to get any cookies. So, okay. Well, Kenley tells us here exactly what Paul is telling us. You need to focus. Whenever our military units go out, there's a message that's given, and everyone understands this. Mission is number one. This is the focus. This is what you're out there to do. And Paul says, this is your focus. Success is only possible when each remembers the simple fact, we are focused on a mission. Do not get drawn off mission objective by distracting circumstances. True joy comes when you keep mission focused. Write down Matthew 16:23. The Lord says, you are not setting your mind on God's interest but man's. Pretty pointed, isn't it? As you're facing dire circumstances, where's your focus? Is it, as Christ says, you're not setting your mind on God's interest but man's? See, there's self-control. It's not about me. It's about mission and about God. Another point, determination, Philippians 1, and oh, how powerful this point is found. You're on a mission, and that mission requires you to be tenacious. Do not allow the world and ungodly people to pull you off compass. Do not do that. Do not compromise your mission by losing sight of your focus. Do not be intimidated. Do not surrender to fear. You're in the heat of battle. And you don't need to allow your faith to be paralyzed. Tenacity is illustrated by Gideon over in Judges 8 and verse 4. There the Bible says, Gideon and his army, as they were chasing the Midianites, Gideon was weary yet pursuing. He's worn out. But he wasn't going to stop. And that's the way we are as well. All right, the next point is that of realism. Philippians 1, 29 through 30. Life on earth is not easy, and it was never promised to be easy, never promised to be fair. Where do we get this idea that fairness works in the world? It doesn't work in the world. The world is working against us, and it's going to use every unfair thing that it can to draw us off of our mission's focus. Compromise is not going to ease the conflict. It's amazing. It's irritating to me that people think that if they just compromise, then things are going to get better. It never gets better. you only have to compromise more and more and more. Only as you stand determined and resolute will you find the end of compromise. Compromise only leads to greater anxiety and nervous disorders that go on and on. You're in a war, and a war involves suffering and conflict. And if you're living a devout life, then the Bible assures you that you are going to suffer for His sake. But this conflict should not rob you of joy, because you are committed to God. Your loyalty to God erases all other loyalties in life. Do you truly believe that your master will take care of his servants? If so, then your confidence is going to bring a wonderful blessing. Look at these Psalms. Psalm 4 and verse 8, "In peace I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety." And then Proverbs 3:24, "When you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet." Why? Because of that determination, that understanding that we're in life. And here is the realistic aspect of life. Those who fail to accept the reality of conflict and the suffering of circumstances will in vain try to manipulate the choices and lifestyles of others. Have you known somebody saying, "Well, if only I can get them to do this, that's really going to solve all the problems"? It doesn't, does it? That just compounds the problems. If you try that, you're gonna find yourself, you've lost your joy, and your life is going to be full of chaotic anxiety. Concluding thoughts. Oh, there's so much in Philippians 1. I hope this challenges you to look at the entire chapter and go home and read it and meditate upon it. But as we look at Philippians 1, we understand we live in a world that's dominated by evil. And so alluring is this evil that many will be deceived into denying Christ and working against Him and doing everything they can to cause you to lose your joy as well. Back in Philippians 1, verses 15 through 17, he says, "Some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife." That's realistic. There are folks out there that are after you to conquer you. But understand, everybody has a choice on how they react to this world, and those who want to will choose to refuse Jesus Christ. And this really is the crucible of self-control, as I look at it. Here is where you come to the ultimate test of Christianity, is how do you deal, how do you survive in these circumstances? Sometimes your plans are not God's plans. That's a rude awakening for some folks. Sometimes your plans are not God's plans. Illustrating Paul. He wanted to go to Rome as a preacher. Philippians 1, he is in Rome, but as a prisoner. Well, he was submissive. He did what God wanted him to do. When you face circumstances in life that seem overwhelming and all seems hopeless, remember Paul and his situation. He makes this point, 2 Corinthians 12, verses 7 through 10. He said, "There was given to me a thorn in the flesh. I implored the Lord three times that it might leave me. But we know it didn't." He says, "Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake." And then he makes this point. He says, "For when I am weak, then I am strong." Now, that's powerful. And that not only applies to Paul, but that applies to you and me as well. If we are to have joyous victory in this life, it comes from optimism. And that is an optimistic trust in God that sees good things in every situation. I like the story about a day laborer that he had a job. And the job was digging a ditch. I don't know how many of you dug ditches, but I have, and I can tell you it's an experience that I'm glad is in my past and I hope is not in my future. Because they had me digging ditches in muddy water. And that's worse than digging ditches in dry dirt. But anyway, this day laborer, he was hired out, and his job was to dig a ditch along this highway. He was glad for the job, but he had walked 3 miles to get to it. But he was very diligent, very faithful in what he was doing. And so one morning he got there. The workers around about him loved being near him because he was a genuine optimist. He could always find something good about a situation. So he got there after 3 miles from his home, began to work on the ditch, and he discovered he'd been careless. And he walked over to one of his fellow workers and he says, "I've gone and done it now. I left my lunch at home." And just walking 3 miles back, 6 miles total, wasn't very appealing. But then he thought, and suddenly he just started smiling and kind of quietly laughing to himself. And he told the fellow, and he says, "You know, it's a good thing that I did that. For the matter of the fact, I left my teeth at home too." Think about it. Sometimes you think you need out of a dire situation, and it's only going to make the matters worse. And that's what Paul is telling us here in Philippians chapter 1. Next week, as we continue, we're going to look at chapter 2, one of my favorite chapters of the entire Bible, because it talks about how to be joyful over when you're in the midst of those irritating people. You may not have that problem, but you can listen to it and understand so you can help somebody else that deals with them. But I enjoy Philippians, and I hope that you do too. There's a message of joy. Joy is not how you feel. Joy is that confident trust and assurance that God is in control. A number of times I've been overseas, and I've been locked horns with different bureaucrats that just wanted to cause me sleepless nights. And I'd do whatever I could, and finally you get to the end, and there's nothing more to do. And I remember on one particular time, it really was catastrophic, I thought. And so I said, "Lord, I've done everything I can. Now, what are you going to do about this?" And the amazing thing was that the next day, I get a call from the governor and from a senior deputy, and somehow things just worked out, not because of anything I'd done. And so now, whenever a situation comes up, I do what I can. And then I say, "Lord, what are you going to do with this mess?" And it always works out. That's what Paul said in Philippians chapter 1. You can be joyful in dire circumstances, not as you want the things to work out, but God will work those things out. Next week, we'll talk about difficult people. Mark it down. It will not happen again.